That aside, we'll start the lecture now. So when I was given the topic, it says I should give lectures on group theory. And I was very ambitious, so I put a group theory there. Then I get through the subject, and I was soon drawn in the sea. So I think, and I have a few handy textbooks on the side, so I decided to rename this lecture as group theory in a nutshell. And of course, you see those books that are in a nutshell. It's pretty huge nutshell, which you're still not able to, I still can't cover enough material in 5 lectures so that I can call it group theory in a nutshell. So I guess I'll call it the group theory in the world's smallest nutshell. So I select some topics that are self-consistent, and that's the maximum of topics I can cover in 5 lectures. So it's not a very big nutshell. Okay, so let's have the outline of these 5 lectures. I have, as I have said, that the first one today will be decoupled from the rest. We'll devote one lecture and only one lecture on finite groups. And since I'm using this beautiful reference, it's called the visualizing finite groups, I probably kind of do one figure per minute, but I'll try to approach that limit. Okay, so then we'll learn some concepts you probably have already heard of. What is a group? What is subgroup? What is normal subgroup? What is cross product and stuff? And we'll revisit them today. But then we'll rapidly move to Lie group. As you might suspect, if this one is called a finite group, this one is probably infinite. It's actually continuous. But that will be our subject for the whole next week. Then the second one would be just introduction to Lie group, and the third one would devote to the very important concept of the structure constants of Lie groups. And they really deserve a lecture because if you know about the structure constant of Lie group, you know everything. And then we'll devote another lecture entirely to SU2. And I'll actually call it everything about SU2, literally everything. If we haven't covered everything in the lecture, we'll cover everything else in the tutorial. And then the last lecture, I don't know, some miracle happens. And we learn one Lie group called SU2. And then miracle happens, by the end of the 5th lecture, we'll try to classify all the semi-simple Lie group. Okay, so that's the outline. And today, as we said, we're focusing on visualizing finite groups. Or, in my own words, I'll call it how I stopped worrying and start loving group theory. Okay, so group theory is a theory to study the symmetry of things. And it's really ubiquitous. Take an orange as example. So this orange, if I rotate it around this axis, it mostly looks essentially the same. If it's a really fresh orange, it probably looks better. But, so this will be the topic of next week. To stay on topic, I'll peel the orange. Orange, after it's peeled, especially a mandarin orange, you realize that it has individual pieces. And now if I rotate it, I have to make sure this mark line on top of each other. So it's about a breakdown, my continuous group that I can rotate all in the whole circle down to I can only rotate about 36 degrees at once. Otherwise, it doesn't look exactly the same. And of course, if I eat this orange, that turns it into something else. Okay, other food is also symmetric, and then when you, you know, eat at the bistro, you should always say, wow, this donut is symmetric, pancakes are also symmetric. But suppose we gain some energy from eating all this food, and then we'll grab the famous toy of Rubik's Cube. So this Rubik's Cube, well, it's a cube, and you probably, when you get this Rubik's Cube, says, we have the following basic instructions. The basic instruction involves grabbing a face, it has six of them, turn it a quarter counterclockwise, all a quarter clockwise, and that's it. If you know all these basic moves, which involves grabbing a face, taking a quarter turn either way, then you can perform all the possible moves. In particular, if I made a move and I says, I regret it, I don't want to make that move. For Rubik's Cube, it's particularly simple. You just take the same face, turn the different way. If you have made a counterclockwise turn, you do a clockwise turn, that will undo the deed. And of course, if you go to online, you can see tons and tons of algorithm how to solve this cube. And if you follow this algorithm, then eventually you will solve the puzzle. And since this is what I'm going to claim, is all the possible moves you can make on this Rubik's Cube form a group. So this might be the best time to introduce what is a group. The group is really, the formal definition is as follows. Group is a set, G for group, has a lot of elements, has a binary operator, I'll call it a circle, defined on the set. Binary operator is really say, take two elements, I'll bring you to some other element. And sometimes you'll hear about group multiplication, that sometimes is ambiguous. But I might also refer them as the multiplication, because the multiplication indeed is a good binary operator. Okay, but that's not a group. A group, in order to become a group, first, we have to have the binary operator to be closed. Closed means we take an element, element A, element B, both inside the set, and I act as a circle object on it, and I get some A circle B, it had a better still remain in the set. So it's like this cube, if I do one move, I do another move, I still get a Rubik's Cube, some configuration. Of course, if I take one square off, that's not a lot. Okay, then, so you need it closed, and you also need it to be associative. So you can combine moves into new moves. So if I have one move, a second move, and a third move, I can combine the second move and the third move, yield a new move, or I can combine the first move and the second move, call it a new move. But then, all in all, I'm doing is first move, followed by second move, followed by the third move. It'll be the same. So in particular for Rubik's Cube, this associativity is guaranteed because we define the binary operator is take a move and followed by another move. It's a sequential thing. Okay, the next, we need a identity. Normally, you will often see this thing is called E. And E has this property, is it act with A, or A act with E, you get A. It doesn't change anything. So for our Rubik's Cube, identity is do absolutely nothing. If you do nothing and do something, or do something then do nothing, it's equals to that doing something. Okay. And for the last property, if we have an identity, we can define something called a inverse. Let me just move this a little bit. So for any element, we're supposed to find A inverse such that A and A inverse or A inverse and A should equals identity. So this has already mentioned, if you regret your move doing this and you don't want it, doing this, you don't want it, you can just turn it back. Okay, so this is the formal definition of group. In order for you to be a group, you need to be a set with binary operator, you need to be closed, associative, has an identity, and then we can find inverse. Okay, so in order to solve this puzzle, I have a few options. I could take a random walk among all the possible moves. That turns out to be usually not successful. I can also go online, find some algorithm, and make some turns. That's nice. Normally, that solves the cube, but it's not optimal. Fun fact about this Rubik's cube. Apparently, mathematicians and the computer scientists have studied. It says the golden number is 26. Given any crazy configuration you can ever thought about, and if you have a powerful enough computer, it will bring it back in 26 steps. So how do I actually, as a person, try to find this optimal move? So this is what I envision. I have this thing called a big book, gigantic book. And what this gigantic book does is every book, it has a picture of the Rubik's Cube, and it says, if I have this configuration, I can just flip my book, and it says, on page 1234, it's this particular cube, and I'm 15 steps away from optimal solution. And not only on the page, it tells this, it also tells, if you take the white side, turn it a quarter, counterclockwise, you will go to the next page, say at 2035 and 6, whatever. And then it says you take this white cube, go to another turn, it also tells me where I should go. But for basically all the 12 basic moves I can do to the cube, this book just gave me an arrow says, please turn to page this and this. If you do this move, you'll get one step closer to your original configuration. But if you do the opposite move, you will be one step far away. Now this would be awesome. If I have this book, I can just open this book, find my original configuration, turn the book, follow the instruction, and I'll get to solve the cube optimally. And this actually has an official name in group theory. This big book is what is called a Cayley diagram. Then this will be our primary visual aid, the visual thing, the visual aid for group theory. But the problem is, okay, there would be some guy very ambitious want to make this big book. Unfortunately, this book, big book, would have 43 billion pages. So not very feasible. And actually, this number makes me really dizzy. I'm so dizzy, I'm gonna take a rest and pull out a mattress. Because you might have heard about this, especially in PI, that some people believe sleep is for the weak. But for other people, they might be troubled by the following problem. Says the how I can flip a mattress such that I can prolong the lifetime. Right, if you have a really fancy mattress and then you sleep on it in a certain way day after day, it comes with dents. But if you can circle all the configurations, then this mattress will last for a long time. So this is a real life problem. And in order to solve it, as a theoretical physicist, my first reaction is, let me take a spherical mattress in the vacuum. Well, it turns out, this problem is easy enough that we should just stick with the mattress problem. So I guess the next thing we'll introduce, a Cayley diagram is called the Cayley diagram of the mattress group. So suppose I have a mattress, and I label them just because after I change the configuration, I want to remember which configuration I'm in. It's labeled in a way that this is the bed head. And you can see all this configuration of the matrix is specified by the letter closest to my hand that is visible. So I'll call it this matrix stasis A. Fair enough? Okay, so what can we do with my matrix? Well, I can do a horizontal flip. That will lead to status C. And if I have a matrix, I can also do a vertical flip. That leads to the status D. And it's very interesting, if I'm at status D, I do a horizontal flip, I reach matrix status B. And since there's only A, B, C, D for status, I experience all the status. It's like my, okay, tiny book. But this tiny book can put in one page, says if I start at a status A, and if I do a horizontal flip, I'll reach status C. If I do a vertical flip, I reach status D. And if I do a horizontal flip, I reach status B. And if I do a vertical flip, I go back to stage C. So this is like my big book. If I'm at a configuration, it'll tell me that what basic moves can be done. If I do this basic move, where I'll be. So this is the Kelly diagram. Well, not quite. The thing is, I can't just say today I want to flip matrix, then I draw a Kelly diagram, tomorrow I have a cube, then I draw, well, cube is different, but I have something else like a piece of toast, then I draw another Kelly diagram. Or suppose I have two light switches. The one basic move is turn the first switch. The second basic move is turn the second switch. And if you think about it, the configuration of these two switches, if you label them carefully enough, you can also draw something like this. So this is the power of group series. It's abstract. So this is not, this is useful, but not, we can do something more useful by not labeling the node. Well, I still should distinguish the horizontal flip and the vertical flip. I can distinguish them by using different color or drawing double lines, but they should be distinguished. So this is actually what is called the Kelly diagram. And this Kelly diagram is actually called Klein 4. Okay, let me write the name once. Normally just refer as the V4, and as our fellow Germans can tell us, the 4 starts with V in German. In Deutsch? Yeah. Oh, very good. So everything makes sense. So V4 is Klein 4, and it looks like this. So here is actually a story says about our very famous Richard Feynman. So apparently Richard Feynman was refused to go to the army because the psychiatrist think he's mentally ill. This is actually true. You can see his biography. But then the rumor is, this is why he is refused, because he played a trick on the psychiatrist. So the psychiatrist asked, put your two hands out. So Richard Feynman do this. One palm up, one palm down. Psychiatrist frowned on him, says, no, the other way. So Richard Feynman did this. Still one palm up, one palm down. Okay. Maybe this will lead to psychiatrist's conclusion. But the point is, even simply flipping hands, it's described by the Klein 4 group, except Feynman is very clever. Instead of using basic move to follow psychiatrist's suggestion, he did a combined move, which let's see here. And if you map this guy, this flipping hands thing back to our matrix, it really says I could do a horizontal flip, vertical flip to reach status B, but I can simply just rotate it 180 degrees. So we shall add that move as well. And the reason we can add it is Kelly diagram actually doesn't care that if you are being a little bit suboptimum. You are using more generator needed. But that's fine. It's still a fine Kelly diagram. Kelly diagram just says if you have nodes and you connect them appropriately as how the group, the binary operator acts, as long as you have include all the nodes and all the nodes has generators coming out of them, it's a fine Kelly diagram. So I guess now would be the good time for summarize what we have learned about the K-Lie diagram. Well, basically, I just want to summarize how do we actually draw one. Well, as I have already drawn one, that's precisely how we draw one, but it's nice if we have a recipe. So how to draw K-Lie diagram, as we'll draw something slightly more complicated. So step one, pick generators. What's generators? Our generators, it's something that generates the group. So if I have some element, you provide me a binary operator. Using this element alone, I'll get the whole group. That's called a generator. Then the smart case is we can choose horizontal flip and a vertical flip. Then we get Klein 4 already. But if you choose horizontal flip, vertical flip, and the rotation, well, you still get a K-Lie. It's still a valid K-Lie diagram. And we'll see why sometimes choosing a more than minimum set of generator, or choosing two instead of one generators is actually fruitful. Okay, so we pick some generators, and then we pick our favorite configuration. My configuration is A, but if you choose C or D, nobody really cares. But if you do GRE, I heard C is actually better for some reason statistically. But anyway, pick your favorite configuration. And the reason we can do that is that if you look at all the diagrams we're going to draw today, they are all very, very symmetric. No matter which node you start with, you will arrive at looking similar K-Lie diagram. Again, looking same K-Lie diagram. And then we pick our favorite configuration and draw a node and label it. Label just big, yes.
I just didn't understand what is, for example, in this group, what is the binary operator that we have and how it connects to the generator?
Okay, so in this case, the binary operator is again making sequential moves. So for them H, so what we can write down as equation would be H followed by a V will give me rotation. So that's the binary operator.
Right, so actually the
Group
is of the movement.
Yes, right, very good. The group is of the collection of the movements, but it's easier to draw the states. I can always start with the state and call that one identity and make a move, reach the different state. You are completely correct. The element should be the move. But it's much easier to draw the resulting state. If I always start with the same state, then all the states is one-to-one correspondence to all the moves, so that's fine. It's just easier to draw a K-Lie diagram that way. But you are completely right. It should be the move as the element. So if I really write my Klein 4 group out, it should have been H, V, R, and E four elements. And all, if you're a little bit more algebraic intensive, you can write down as A. So it's a group generated by A and B, such that we have A square equals B square equals E, and you have AB equals BA. So you list your generators, you list how generators is related to the identity, and you list how they are related. So that can also describe a group, but if you, it's okay. But yes, it's a very good point. The group, all this movement, all these groups derive from a game or if matrix flipping something, what I claim I'm labeling my states, but what is actually forming the group such that I can act the binary operator on is the move that leads to that state. But it's very hard to label my node as the move leads to the state. Okay, very good.
Are the H and V are two generators?
Yes, very good. Because H and V, I can use H and V, I can generate R. So I can call H and V the two generators of the group.
Okay. generators are basically a subset of elements.
Very good. Generators are a subset of elements such that if you use the binary operator on them, eventually you are able to reach all the elements in the group. And as particularly emphasized, generators does not have to be minimum. You could choose HV as the generators, but you can also choose HVR as the generators because they, of course, reach all the group elements because they are all the group elements. Okay, more questions?
How do you know what is the actual minimum number of generator units?
Oh, that I don't know. You just have to try. Oh, you can draw the Cayley diagram, draw the cyclograph, draw the all kinds of graphs, and try and figure out, try and error. But there's no way you gave me a finite group. It's like, oh, those two generators are enough. No, we don't. We pick an element, see how much we can generate. And if we have something else, we pick another one out of the something else and generate more elements until we reach the full set. We're like, yeah, we're happy. Then sometimes you even want extra, but if you want to get the minimum, you play that game. And even that game might not lead you to the minimum set, as we will soon see. So you have to play that game multiple times to make sure you find the minimum set. But as we also will see, the smallest number of generators are not necessarily the most useful. But we'll get there. But like we have a favorite configuration, step 3 says explore. The group explorer do everything to you for you. But we explore says for a node, we explore all generators that it's picking. So we already pick some generators. We use these generators, use all these generators, and you draw nodes on. So if you use that example, I'll use, they say we have a H, I have this, I have a V, I have this. And then, of course, this is incomplete. Step 4 says repeat step 3 until we're done. So we go back to step 3. We say, ha, now we have a new node. Then for the new nodes, we need to explore the generators, how we find a new node. And for this new node, we explore our generators, and then we find our final. And we're like, OK, we get all the nodes. Every node have been explored by all generators. So finally, we're done. So that's how we draw a Cayley diagram. And we're going to draw many more of them. But now let's come back to my matrix problem, because I started with a question, I should answer it. So the matrix problem, basically, if you want to get the best of the matrix, you want to explore all the configuration as evenly as possible. So you really want to go all the other nodes once and come back to yourself. And as you see, the horizontal flip, vertical flip, vertical horizontal flip, vertical flip would work. But actually, I don't know if you have ever vertical flipping a matrix. It's hard work. So the golden rule of the matrix company is you spin in the spring and flip in the fall. And hence we'll conclude with our matrix group, although we'll come back to it later, because it somehow shows up other places. But with the knowledge of the Cayley diagrams, now we're just going to explore the famous 5 families of finite groups. They are totally not complete, but they are famous. Okay. And before that, are there any more questions? So group is, yes.
It's all Cayley diagrams are fully connected.
All Cayley diagrams, well, they have to, right?
They have to be fully connected.
Yes, because they all have to somehow connect it to the identity.
So actually, like after step 4, you should also
connect
all the, right?
No, you just repeat step 4. So it's actually it's in mathematical language, it's actually do this thing. Well, we haven't done everything. So you just keep repeating. So you explore this node and find a new node. As long as you have new nodes, you repeat step 3. As long as you have new nodes, explore step 3 until we finally say, well, we normally know the order, the number of elements in the group. So you know the order is 4, you say, hi, there are 4 nodes, and you check each node, you have explore all generators then with them. Yep.
You can also think about it as a table, right? I mean,
yes, that's the multiplication table that everybody knows about it, that's why we're not talking about it. And it's much harder for me to list them. It's more fun to draw circles and lines. Okay, I'll come back to this. But when you do these generators, as I currently has seeming very bold to choose lines connecting nodes. As we will soon to see, actually we should have using arrows to indicate which direction you're going. Especially, but for our matrix, say that you turn twice, you go back to yourself, then the direction doesn't matter. But if you have much more thing than to do than flipping 180 degrees, you would have to use arrows. Okay, can we move on? We'll come back. So, but the first family, you might have heard of it. It's called the cyclic group. Okay, cyclic group basically describe the symmetry of a propeller that has N leaves. Well, I can make a propeller with 2 leaves. And then you can imagine that there were 3 leaf propellers, fans, and you can have 8 leaves. You can make an octopus. But these things, basically what a cyclic group says, that algebraically it says take an element and you take it to nth power, you get back to the identity. So all the cyclic group has the same description. They have other description we'll get to there, but one of the description is take a group element, acting on itself, acting on itself, acting on itself, eventually you will get it back. So for example, the orange, this particular orange is C10 because it has 10 pieces. After turning 10 times, it would get back to the original orange. Okay, so this cyclic group, as you can see, it has one generator, not the most interesting ever. And if you think about it, I started with one element, and then move on to the next element, and then move on to the next element, move on to the next element, until I finish the N thing. So this is really a general Cayley diagram of cyclic group. Because you have one element. There's nothing, it's like explore the generator. Well, there is one generator. You just move. Eventually you'll get back to yourself. You might think cyclic group is silly then. But nevertheless, let me look at carefully what's a C6. Okay, so C6, as we have just said, definitely admit such a description is you from identity, you move to A, you move to A square, you move da la da la da la da la da la, and then you draw a cycle. And now you say I have to draw arrows because this direction you move to A, the other direction you move to A to the fifth. But you're like, why am I looking at this? Okay, let's come back to the question that's been asked a few times, says, what about the minimum generator thing? The smallest number of generators is absolutely 1 for all cyclic group. But suppose I'm silly. I decided not to choose A as my generator. I'll choose A squared. Well, nobody forbids me to do so. They say you pick my generator. My favorite element is A squared, maybe because there's so many square laws. Okay, so I go to A square, I go to A to the fourth, then I come back to myself. And of course I'm in trouble because I didn't explore all the nodes. That's definition, not a generator, well, not a good enough generator set. I have to get something else. So we say, well, I'm determined not to use A because if I use A, I'll just get that diagram. So now I can choose A3. So then I get this node. So I can choose a second generator to help me to get to the full group. So now I have A3. If I use my first generator, this going circle thing, A3 will take me to A5, A5 will take me back to A1, and A1 will take me back to A3. And then remember, we have to explore all the nodes to make sure all generators have been done. And obviously, I need one here and another one here. So now you look at this diagram, it's maximally symmetric from any node. I'll probably reach exactly the same status. So this is certainly a valid Cayley diagram for C6. And they're not looking so pretty, but we can make it pretty. I can just draw my line, arrange my notes slightly different. Yes, question.
You said that you start from A3.
And A3 go back.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It's on top of each other. I can draw it, but you wouldn't see it. If it has an orbit of two, then you would only draw one of them because it's understood.
Yeah, but I'm not understanding how you can choose like to go from A3 to A5.
Oh, that's the white generator.
Sure, you're playing A2, but
yeah. So because what I claim is A2, A3 together will generate the same whole group. I'm not claiming that A2 and only A3. So when you claim the generator, as soon as you put an element in this generator set, I'm allowed to use both elements to generate things. And anything I generated, I can also use them to generate the things. And the problem with my first choice is I generate three elements, but no matter how I combine them together, I wouldn't get two new elements anymore.
Okay, so you can say A is a good generator, you just need one.
Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly. So that's the point. The point is you could have just chosen a single generator, but sometimes I decide to be silly and I choose two generators. That's okay. You yield this Cayley diagram. It's a little, yes.
But it was like if it was C odd. Then A square would expand the whole.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's true. That's very good. Very good point. If I have like a C prime, then any element will be the same. You will forever stuck with this diagram. That's why I choose C6. Okay, we'll talk about the other numbers. But the C6 is interesting because I could draw the nodes. So let me do the following. I'm going to pull this triangle to be really large, and then shrink the smaller triangle and then flip it. Or I could just say, I arrange my nodes as from E to A. I arrange the nodes in the same way as this, but I pick my generator differently. So maybe that's not the best way of arranging my nodes. I should have done just this. E goes to A square. Okay, let's just rename A square to be C, B square, A cube to be D. Okay, so I reach to C, which is formally our A square, and now I get to C square, is formally my A force, and then if I use my A cube, I reach to D, which is formally my A cube. And then you can continue. Let me draw all the nodes in the same color. And I can continue to this guy, which is CD. And then we can continue to this guy, which is C squared D. And these are just renames for A square, A to the fourth, A to the cube, A to the fifth, and A. Okay, let me write the original name as well. Okay, so this is A square, A to the fourth, and this is A to the cube because that's the generator, and you push with this arrow again, so you get to A to the five, and you push it again, you get to A. So suppose we have six nodes, and I rearrange them. I could draw my diagram this way. Now you can think about pulling one triangle really big and flip the other triangle. So this is a rearrangement of that Kelly diagram, but it's the same Kelly diagram. It is still, we still describe C6. Okay, are we okay with C6? So basically I say if I choose different generators, I should have been smart and rearrange my nodes differently, and this should have been where I get to. And really, this big triangle is mapped to this triangle. These three red lines are mapped to the three lines. And this gets pulled up. This gets pulled closer. This gets pulled closer. OK, so why do we go through this trouble and do this? It's because there's something called a subgroup. Subgroup, the formal definition of subgroup is that suppose I have group G and I have a subset A which is smaller than G, and then A somehow is still a group. Then we claim A is G's subgroup. It's subset, it's a group, so it's a subgroup. And in particular, identity itself is always the trivial subgroup. And G itself is always the trivial subgroup. So every group has two trivial subgroups itself and identity alone. Well, they are trivial, so we're not interested with a, are there any other subgroup we can see? For example, in particular in C6, after we rearrange our diagram look like this, so in terms of Kelly diagram, the subgroup is easy to spot. If you have seen some structure that you are familiar with, then that is a subgroup. So if you just look at this diagram, says, hey, I could just take the outer circle here, this is a subgroup. This is something I've already seen. This is one element to go to the next element, go to the next element and come back. This is what I will have introduced at C3. And further, if you take this little part, and you see this, I'm familiar as well. It's one node to go to something and come back to itself. So this is C2. So the nice part about rearranging the Kelly diagram, choosing more than necessary number of generators, is some rearrangement of the Kelly diagram actually leads us to realize there are subgroups inside this group. And it's like the same idea, we just keep chopping things down and hopefully things get easier and easier, and of course standard model has lots of parameters, but for the particular case we have, if you have a C6 and you can chop it down to find a subgroup C3 and a subgroup C2 in it, and we're happy. Says, okay, that's nice. If you give me a Kelly diagram, if it's nicely arranged according to this subgroup, then I can immediately just by look, I already can identify the subgroups. Okay? We're good with C6? Yes? Come again? Yes. I have to pick because I always have to pick identity. And then I have to, if I wanted to be a C2, want to come back to itself, yes, I have to pick E and A3. And now it comes up. What about the other pairs? Are there something called cosets that will come to it? But for now, let's just say I want to identify something that looks like a Kelly diagram I already know. And I have to include the identity, and it's either this guy or the outside cycle. Okay. So then you might have curious questions What about other cyclic group? Can you always arrange like this? And you can try. C4 doesn't work. Actually, there is a theorem says that it only works like this in some particular case. But before that, I shall introduce what we called a cross product, direct product. Direct product is a nice thing, says given me group one and group two, I can just merge them together, make a bigger group. So that's why I learn all the simple groups, so I can make bigger groups and hopefully I learn all of them. But of course, that's not feasible, even these basic blocks, there are tons of them. But nevertheless, suppose I have C2 and a C3, and I say, how do I make a direct product of them? So in terms of Cayley diagram, this is rather visual. It says, draw C2. But when you draw, make your node giant. Here is a giant C2. Okay, then we'll draw C3 in them. So now we're very familiar with C3. It is a three-element loop. And then, after you put C3 inside this giant node, I'm going to cheat because I'm on the board. I'm just going to erase the blowed up node. And then you're like, what about the original C2 generator? Well, I have a corresponding element, and I'll just link them. So there is the corresponding, this is the up one, up link up, left, left link left, red link right. So this is how you do direct product in terms of Cayley diagram. You just draw a giant version of one of the group and put the other group inside. And then you use the giant nodes generator to link them. Ah, very good. You notice something very important. Isn't this what I have already drawn? Yeah, indeed, this thing, if I just squash it down, this is exactly this. And we make a very nice conclusion. C2 direct product must be equals to C6 because they have exactly the same Cayley diagram, which in a fancier language, we call it isomorphic. If you think that the two groups are exactly the same. But okay, but direct product is not that bad. We can actually have the formal definition of the direct product, which will come back here. So the formal definition of direct product is saying that if I'm given a group G and another group G prime, how do I make a bigger group out of them? Oh, they say, oh, come on, that's like two dimensions. I can just make an ordered pair. Well, that's actually exactly what happened. In direct product. So direct product says I have a group G and another group G prime, and I want to product them. Then I say, well, I'll just put the first element here, second element here, and then make a ordered pair, as you have already seen many times in coordinate system, and I'll collect all of them, say, this are the direct product. Sure. Well, I have to define a binary operator. So let's take some sample elements, J1, J1 prime, and the circle, I don't know, fancy circle, smiling face. Okay, G2 and the J2 prime, the smiling face operator says, well, it's a direct product, so I'll just use whatever is defined in group G to do the first coordinate, and whatever is defined in group 2 to do the second. So that's the formal definition of a direct product. Producing Cayley diagram can blow up big nodes. In some other language, you can think about direct product as a pair of pointers. And you can fix a pointer pointing to one element in G, then the other pointer in the G prime just travel and experience all the elements. And you meet a bunch of elements in this big group, and they can move this pointer and move the pointer again. Okay, so this is not very interesting, but at least now we know some ways of producing big groups. So we could have never known about the C6, only know C2 and the C3, but as long as we know direct product, we also produce this C2 cross C3, which is actually C6. Okay, so with this, I would like to move on to the next family of groups. Okay, but before that, let me ask you a silly question that you might have heard about. The question is, what is purple and a commute? It's an abelian grape. Okay, so the next family is the abelian group. So as you know that the grapes are purple, so the abelian must mean commute. Okay. So abelian groups, okay, no, abelian groups are the group, in addition of everything else, the binary operator commutes with itself. It's nice. It's a very, very nice property. It's actually so nice, and it's so constrained. It constrains the abelian groups really a lot, such that actually there is a fundamental theorem of abelian groups says, oh, all the abelian groups, all the finite abelian groups, any of them, they are really just a direct product of a bunch of cyclic groups. You get, it's a theorem proved by the mathematician Franz, says that any of them, it might be a really, really, really long list, but that's okay. We understand all the cyclic groups by the fact that we know how to draw all of them. We understand a cross direct product, and hence we're done with abelian groups. Okay, groups. Okay, very good. So the second family we'll spend in 1 minute. And we'll move on to the next family, because the second family we're done. We know all the cyclic groups, and we know how to do direct products of them. Then we know all the abelian groups, at least the finite ones. Okay. So the only thing you need to remember is to ask your friends about purple and commute. But anyway, let's move on to the third family. The third family is known as the dihedral group, also known as the polygon group. Well, as name suggested, it describes the symmetry of polygons. Okay, so in particular, it's actually not quite. It's true if it's a polygon, but sometimes I'm just obnoxious. I want to study about n-gons. Then I have to define dihedral groups very carefully. It says it's generated by a 100-degree reflection and the rotation by 360-degree over n. Okay, it works. It works with a triangle. This is equilateral triangle. And I can reflect, I get the same triangle. And I can rotate 120 degree, still the triangle. Okay, but we'll study the triangle very carefully later. Let's talk about when n equals one. This thing, I decided to call it a unigon. Then I realized the unigon is actually the hybrid between unicorn and dragon. It's a very powerful, mystical creatures. So remember, point is very powerful. And hence we always use point mass, right? Okay, the point is actually way more symmetric than D1. But if you read the definition of D1, the only thing we get left is the 180-degree reflection. We're done. N equals 2. What I can call it a bigon. And I say, well, bigon is really a line. But then says, let bigons just be bigons. OK, a line is really just a matrix. You look at it very, very far away, then it's a line, right? If you make this matrix super long and not very wide, and you look at it very far away, that's a line. It's also more symmetric than D2, but by this definition, it's really C2, direct product C2, which is the matrix group V4. And I'll leave this as an exercise. You can draw C2 and draw the direct product, blow up some nodes, and you realize this is true. And that leads us to the first comp. I shouldn't say complicated. OK. Well, leads us to the first interesting, even more interesting group, D3, the symmetry of a triangle. Okay. As you can also just draw a triangle on your notebook and flipping it. So you probably want to actually draw it on the paper, not on the pad, so you don't drop it. But you can just follow me and say, grab a triangle. In order to know which triangle, which configuration am I at, I label them as 1, 2, 3. And after flip, it's still labeled 1, 2, 3. So let's do this together. If I have such a triangle, D3, what do I do? Basically, I say, I'll call this triangle this way. I'll always name it start with the top and going counterclockwise. You can also try to start with the left and going clockwise. That's okay. But that would be my way of labeling it. So this first state is called 1, 2, 3. And following the counterclockwise 120 degree, I get to 3, 1, 2. And then I can continue to do this. I get a 2, 3, 1. Okay, if you're too far away, then I suggest you draw a triangle, just do it. You draw a triangle on your notebook and just do it. Okay, but I can also do, I have 1, 2, 3. And I'll flip it, which is the 180 degree reflection, and hence we arrived at a 1, 3, 2. Different color, because this is a different generator. Right? And then, of course, I can also continue rotate this. I get 2, 1, 3. Very interesting. Where should I put the 2, 1, 3? Well, you can flip it to see. The other side says 2, 3, 1. So if I want my diagram to work out, I'd better put the 2, 1, 3 over here. Right? And I have one more left, which would be the 3, 2, 1. And this would be the Kelly diagram of D3, because I explored all the configurations I got. Right? Makes sense? OK, these numbers are kind of like a daisy. I'll just redraw it. There's a node, come to this node, come to this node, come to this node. And then there's a different generator. And now I have a node, come to a node, come to a node, come back to itself. Interesting. You're like, aren't you drawing this diagram like 5 times already today? The answer is no. There is a fundamental difference between, oh, that's a problem. Where is my beloved C6? Not right here. Ah, very good, it's twisted. So this guy is going this way all the time. And this guy has to go the other way. Remember when I was flipping my triangle, and you can also test by yourself, I cannot put this node over here because these two are not related by this generator. So it's, huh, we were like, would that even make a difference? There would. The difference is C6 is abelian, which means we know everything about it. This guy is the first non-abelian group we see today. It says if you follow the white and the purple, you get here. But if you follow the purple and the white, you get there. It's non-abelian. Which means they definitely are not the same group. So I can again label them as this is E, this is R, this is R squared, this is F, and this must be FR, and this must be FR squared. So this is just some algebraic notation, says there's generated by R and F, R cubed is E, F squared is E. And what we realize is FR is actually equals to R squared F, not RF. In particular, it's not abelian. Okay, so, but you're like, come on, it can't be that different. If I just look at it, I already see my familiar C3 subgroup. Correct. They still have this big triangle. I said, if you look at it, you find something so familiar, then you find a subgroup, indeed. Well, I still see this guy. Yes, we still have a C2N subgroup. So what's the difference? What's the difference? What's this arrow is trying to tell me? So now we'll have to have some more concepts called cosets. That will make us to realize why this thing is different. Okay, I'll leave the C6 there. So coset, how do I make coset? I have a subgroup. Say E and F. Cosets is basically now you have all the elements and then you can just put A multiplied by E and F, you get A, oh, sorry. Yes, I will use, pick a particular one, R, so I get R and RF. So this thing is called a left coset. So coset, you just say you have a subgroup, when you grab an element, I choose R, you can choose anything that you want, you will make some other thing. So R and RF, which is this guy, is this thing. This is my left coset. It looks sort of like my original subgroup. It looks like a copy, except it doesn't have identity, so I can't call it a subgroup. But it looks like a copy. And of course, you can do it with R squared. You can do it with every single element. And you realize that some of them will repeat themselves. But you can see, I have three left, well, have the subgroup and two left cosets. And this is also a left coset. OK. But of course, if it's called a left coset, then there must be a right coset. So I can do E and F, multiply, do those first, and then do R, so I get R and FR. But remember, the FR and RF, it's not the same. FR is actually that guy. So there is this very weird thing. It's the right coset is this guy. And the other one. OK, I'll draw it. Yeah, that's why I don't want to draw it. Okay. But anyway, the point is the left coset is not equal to the right coset. On the other hand, if we look at our C6, Because the arrows always go same direction. If you go the other direction, in C6, there is this nice scenario that the left coset is equals to the right coset. You can do the same argument. You pick this little thing. You act a square from the left. You act a square from the right. You will get the same. So this must be very special. Indeed, if we have left coset equals right coset, then this subgroup are called a normal subgroup, or sometimes called an invariant subgroup. They're actually very rare, but they are called the normal subgroup anyway. The subgroup EF is this guy. So this subgroup is not a normal subgroup as I just have shown, because the green circle and the red circle doesn't overlap.
So when our group is generated by more than two generators, and we would still be interested in EF, then we would not have only have to multiply it by R, but by anything else
yeah.
that is in that group,
right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. You can multiply by other things. No, you can just say replace R by R squared, replace it by FR, you can generate a bunch. But if you list all those bunches, they all just really fall into these three cosets. That would be a very nice exercise to try it out, that even if you use other element, eventually you will always get these three. Okay, so now we have the concept of normal subgroup. Now we can finally talk about quotient. So you can product the groups, you can also divide them. The quotient says if we have normal subgroup, then you can use this bigger group divided by the normal subgroup, and these cosets themselves form a group. That's a little abstract. In terms of Cayley diagram, you basically go the other way. You collapse this nodes down to this cosets. You replace each coset by one node. And then you're left with the quotient group. So what we learned is C6 divided by C2 is C3. And we can't do the same over here because C2 is not the normal subgroup. What we could do, though, is D3 divided by C3 is C2. So although these two guys is not normal, the bigger circle is still normal. The big one. No matter what, that's the one, that's the subgroup, then this three thing in the middle is the coset. The left coset equals the right coset, so that one is still normal. If it's normal, we can divide it. And you're like, huh, what are you talking about? What I'm saying is, if we have normal subgroup and it's cosets, then we can divide them. And can we go back? Can we think about D3 as some sort of product? Yes, we can. So that's what we call the semi-direct product. And it disappeared. Okay, so semi-direct product. Remember what we do with direct product. We blow up two nodes. We blow up two nodes, and we put a copy in the group, kick in the node, and then we join all those lines. Then we get the direct product. So if I want to do, so first of all, semi-direct product, you have to have a normal subgroup. Then if I want to do C3, semi-direct product C2, that means this time, before actually, I could have blow up the C3. For direct product, it doesn't matter. For semi-direct product, it matters. It's always this guy become a giant node. And then I put a copy of C3 over here.
Can you
this is the norm. You always write the normal one first. This just describes the global structure as true. And then, instead of putting a C3, you put a C3 in some other direction, which is called a rewiring. So a rewiring of the Cayley diagram, just say you take off all the arrows and flip them, rearrange them, and you still want to get a Cayley diagram, but after that, if it's still a Cayley diagram, it's called a rewiring. It's literally take the wear off and do something with them. In this case, you can do the same trick. I have two giant nodes, now I don't want them anymore. And you collect them, the corresponding nodes. And this guy, if you crush it down, will give us D3. So now I learned that D3 is actually a C3, semi-direct product with C2, with C3 being normal. So for direct product, both group G and G prime, they are both normal, so it doesn't matter how you do it. For semi-direct product, the first guy is the normal. The normal guy is the one you want to rewear. And after you rewear and collect them together, then you get a semi-direct product. Okay? And actually, you can see that for all the dihedral group Dn, it's always Cn. Semi-direct product C2. Even the diagram look the same. It's like a CN on the outside and a CN in the inside, but in the other direction. Yep.
Does that mean that these cycles are equivalent to them with respect to relative
convection? Is that what it means? It really means these two are isomorphic. So it's this group is really, you can make a map between these two groups that has one-to-one correspondence. But it's not exactly the same. It doesn't map E to E, doesn't map A to A, doesn't map A to A squared, but it has like some twisted. But these two are isomorphic groups, it's just reworded differently. Okay, so, well, interesting. I'm out of time. I have two more families. So let's quickly go through them. So the next family, so now we understand that all the dihedral groups, we're done. They all look like the same. Then they are all semi-direct product of Cn and C2. Okay, the next family is called the symmetric group. It basically says all the permutation of n elements, which you're like, we already studied. Look, 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1, that's 6 of them. So that's all the permutation. So the first thing we learn is C3, S3 is equals to D3. That's good. And what about S4? Well, I don't know. I kind of draw it now, but here is S4. S4 is basically the symmetry group of pentatonic solids such as a die D6 and die D8. If you play RPG game, you would know them. And those two are dual to each other because if you take all the midpoints and connect together, you get this way. So these two are dual. You can look at them later. I can't find a gigantic die. And so that's S4. And if you do the same thing, you label them, and you do all this rotation, you'll get this guy. And the reason I don't spend any time on this guy is symmetric group, the permutation group, is extremely complicated. There is a fundamental theorem, actually, it's called a Cayley theorem. Cayley theorem says any finite group will be a collection of permutations. So any finite group will be some subgroup of some gigantic permutation group. So if we understand all the permutation group, that means we understand everything. It's not that nice. So we'll postpone this to self-interest. What we could study is something called alternating group. Alternating group is basically half of the permutation group. So if we can't study all of them, I can study half of them. So how do you do half of them? You basically say take every permutation and I square them and I only take the squaring results. If you're interested, you can read the lecture. You can read what I write and you will know about them. And there's A4. Is half of S4, so S4 is crazily complicated. A4 is the symmetry of a tetrahedron, like this. And you know, we can do the same, you can label them as green, yellow, blue, orange, or 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you rotate them, you can rotate them this way. Or a fancy thing you can do is take two edge, you can flip 180 degrees. So those are the symmetries of this tetrahedron. And if you do that, you get this. Okay. I want to tell you the lecture notes are eaten by the goats, but that's unfair. So you will have this diagram drawn. It will be posted. So this will be the Cayley diagram for A4. And this is also Cayley diagram for A4, except this is not organized by the normal subgroup. This guy is not normal. But this V4, the matrix group here, is normal. So if this is normal, then we collapse them together and get the C3 out of it. So what we know about A4 is that we can divide A4 by V4 and get C3. Even nicely, it's a semi-direct product with C3. Okay. With that, I want to end today's class by the official definition of a semi-direct product group. See if I can remember, it's pretty long. A semi-direct product group between G and H, with G being the normal subgroup, is a holomorphism from H to the automorphism group of G, and there is this holomorphism such that I can map G, H, G prime to G, G prime, H theta as a H, but mapped with this homomorphism of this rewiring thing of G, then we multiply by H. Okay. So that's why I didn't teach you that way. I like the rewiring better. Okay, so that's the end of today's class, and we'll come back to talk about something completely different. We'll move on to Lie group. Or sometimes you say Lie group, it's like a French group.